From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. The situation involving the course of action the United States and other world countries will take against Syria for its use of chemical weapons against its people remains fluid. To put it in perspective, we thought it'd be a good idea to talk a bit about the history of Syria and its place in the Middle East, and also learn more about the use of chemical weapons around the world. We turn to Viterbo University history professor Keith Knudsen and UW La Crosse political science assistant professor Adam Van Leer for their perspective on what's happening in Syria. So first, let's talk about Syria and maybe its place in the Middle East. Adam?
I think it's important to keep in mind that when we look at Syria at a number of different levels, we're actually looking at a microcosm of the fighting that's going on within the country between various factions trying to overthrow the regime. We're also actually looking at a regional power struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And then more generally, at the global level, you're looking at sort of the different takes of the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, kind of the West on one side, and Russia and China on the other side. In some ways, when we look at Syria right now, there's a lot of different struggles that are going on between groups with very different goals, very different aims.
Keith?
Yes, domestically, Syria is a multifaceted society. The government has been dominated by one particular minority sect, the Alawites, who've gotten control of the political apparatus that's controlled the country for the last, let's say, 4 to 5 decades. The Ba'ath Party, which is a particularly virulent development of, let's say, political totalitarianism. And against that, then, there has been this regional awakening, the Arab Spring, the movement among the Arabic-speaking, predominantly Islamic people, but of course one significant minority is the Christian populations in these various societies, which often have been protected by the dictators that have been in power. The Arab Spring has been the instigator of a confluence of events that are now erupting, and I think it's fair to say that the Obama administration has tried mightily to stay out of this particular conflict. We as Americans are grappling with the potential of maybe our influence and our power is not going to be irrelevant to developments in the region. And this has been part of the Obama administration foreign policy, the transition to a focus on Asia, maybe trying to get away from the problems of the Middle East that have bedeviled certain administrations in recent history here in the United States.
And we've had a family, the al-Assad family has been leading the country since about 1970, I believe.
Of course, there's one particular incident in Syrian history where the father, Hafez al-Assad, annihilated a city of some 20 to 30,000 people, headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood movement in that society that was repressed remarkably brutally. And so there is this history in Syria, and of course from our American perspective in the Middle East, of brutal politics that historically we've managed to associate ourselves with on maybe some unfortunate occasions, but how are we going to deal with that relationship today, I think, is our relationships with these Middle Eastern governments that, of course, are so significant, a large population, a center of world commerce, but, of course, in the 20th century, the discovery of oil and the foundation of oil economies in our world today.
Adam, did you want to add anything?
I think this is part of the challenge that's facing the United States, and it's a challenge we face throughout this Arab Spring moment, is the degree to which there have been various leaders in power of many of these countries who they weren't always the best for their people, but they still helped maintain a certain level of stability and a certain level of we knew what to expect when we dealt with them in the Middle East. And so part of the challenge that the United States has faced and President Obama and his foreign policy team, as the Arab Spring has sort of swept across countries from Tunisia, Libya, Egypt to Syria, is to what degree is this changing some of the basic our own decisions about, you know, who do we ally ourselves with, which groups do we support, because it's not always clear who's going to come out on top in these contests. Look at what we've seen in Egypt And what does that mean for the U.S. and its role in this very volatile region?
So how is it that Syria has found allies within Russia and even within China?
To understand Syria's relationship with Russia, I think it's important to keep in mind that going back even to the Cold War, Russia or the Soviet Union has actually had a naval base in Syria. Syria has bought a lot of its military equipment from Russia. And so it's a longstanding connection, a relationship between these two countries. And that's part of when we look at Russia today and their support of the Assad regime, their attempts to block UN action on Syria, is for them, it's partly about protecting their military interests, their military base that they have, the presence that they have in Syria. And for China, it comes with sort of along the lines of Russia is also this idea of not necessarily letting the international community meddle too much with the domestic politics of a country.
Yes, I think for China it is that legacy of Western imperialism dividing up that country, humiliating that society, those people. The Chinese government, after the Communist Revolution in 1948, would take a stance that we've had enough of this outside influence and then projecting that principle into their UN Security Council seat. And of course, Russia and China have a veto power at the Security Council. And so I haven't read China so much as a protector of Syria as rather a maintainer of this principle that outside countries, especially Western, formerly imperial countries, maybe in China's view currently imperial countries, should not have a latitude to engage in this very open influence. I think China itself is interested in influence through investment. There is this diplomatic contest and investment forward-looking a contest as well about possible commercial business interests.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are Viterbo University History Professor Keith Knudsen and UW La Crosse Political Science Department Assistant Professor Adam Van Leer. We're talking about the history of Syria. At this point in time, the U.S. has accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons on its people, and Syria and Russia say it wasn't us, it was the rebels. President Obama says Syria has crossed the line in using chemical weapons on its people. How have we gotten to this point where we are? Why is it that the Obama administration is so concerned about this particular incident?
I think the most recent proposal from the Russians that the Syrian weapons would be controlled by international inspectors, maybe even the UN, how that would work, we'll see, is almost an implicit acknowledgement that Syria has these weapons. And we're not talking about corralling weapons that might be in the hands of the rebels. And from my perspective, this is a significant development in Russian acknowledgement that there is a good reason for reeling in its client state, or at least taking this route as opposed to an American military strike. Of course, there's a 1920s convention that says biological chemical weapons will not be used. We paid little attention to that in the 1980s when Saddam Hussein in Iraq used these weapons against the Iranian military and then against the Kurdish people within the territory of Iraq. It's been, from my perspective, an issue that's been bubbling up for some period of time. But then, of course, about a year ago, President Obama talked about a red line if Syria were to use these kinds of weapons. Again, from my perspective, it is the instinct of this president to try to build up international multilateral arrangements as a replacement, perhaps, for American hegemonic, that is, dominant military use to try to police the world. And so in that regard, it might be a useful moment, a useful development for Obama to try to lead our society in this direction. We have a significant element of our country that wants to see the American military power sort of police the world. I'm thinking of Senator McCain and his ally, Senator Graham from South Carolina. But within that same party, then, there's a resurgent sort of isolationist movement with the, I think it's fair to say, within the Tea Party. And then on the other side of the political aisle with the Democrats, there's this unwillingness among a certain segment of the Democratic Party to engage in military action. And that's been fairly longstanding. And I think the two most recent Democratic presidents, both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, then are leading a party that is somewhat hesitant about engaging the world and exercising either military power or, let me just call it, our moral authority perhaps in the world. I think the president is attempting to use this as a foundation for his vision of what American foreign policy might become.
And I think coming back to this issue of chemical weapons, part of what we see going on here, at least in more recent times, you have the longstanding Geneva Conventions sort of banning the use of chemical weapons, but you also have more recently in the 90s attempts to really codify and solidify an international framework that bans this use. And sort of since those more recent attempts have happened, this presents the United States, it presents others with kind of the first opportunity to make some sort of a statement about, all right, here we have a regime or a regime that we believe to have used chemical weapons against its people, with something like 1,400 dead as a result of one particular attack. Given how heinous we think these types of weapons are, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to say or do nothing in this case, or are we going to try and make a stand and just show that there are certain things that are off limits, out of bounds, when it comes to these types of weapons that we have long said should not be used? And so it's part of the challenge, I think, for the Obama administration has been how do we cope with the fact that these weapons have actually been used now? And what sort of response do we take to that?
Why is it that we've classified weapons? We say you can't use chemical weapons to kill 1,400 people, but these airstrike missiles that killed 1,400 people.
Or over 100,000 Syrians
sure.
dead in this conflict. I think the heinous nature and the indiscriminate nature of the weapons, even when they were used in World War I at certain battles, more than a million men, including civilians as well, would die. Once people were gassed, I think our human community began to recognize, you know, we've got to draw the line somewhere, somehow. And these weapons are, I think we are in general agreement around the world, particularly heinous. Now, the question becomes, how are we going to enforce our sense that this is, you know, a red line, this is beyond the pale, this is unacceptable? Do we meet such force with more conventional military force? Of course, another option that's been put out recently, in recent weeks, is trying to indict the Syrian government, its leaders, at the International Criminal Court. It might be nice if the United States of America were a fully functioning member of that organization, and then we would bring a little bit more authority as we would look to that option. Again, I think I go back to this president has been attempting to lead us in a direction, acculturate us into a direction in quite contrasting to the previous administration, that maybe we don't want to be called upon to use this military power and find other ways, more diplomatic, institutionalized methods
yes.
by which we can address these topics. And that is always going to be difficult. All we have to do is look at our own United States Congress, not on these days, but on previous days, on how difficult it is to legislate what a human community wants to engage in. So once we go down the road of diplomacy and international institutional construction, well, then, of course, we're involved in compromise and the give and take that is so problematic for a society that can be a little bit unsparing and anxious about these kinds of developments. The military option is, excuse my finger, but it's quick and it's easy. Well, it's not easy, of course.
Sure.
That's a bad word. It's quicker. It's more determinative. It's something that can be seen for us through the television, and the diplomacy is much less open to the kind of viewing that we'll do if we want to follow this situation.
And I do think this is part of why, so the recent Russian proposal to have Syria hand over its chemical weapons to some sort of international monitoring group, part of the reason why the Obama administration, why others in the U.S. government are interested in maybe giving this a bit more of a hearing. Now, obviously, we don't want this to turn into a stalling tactic. And so this is why countries like France are talking about proposing UN resolutions that would give a firmer timetable to when this has to happen. So it's not a way for the Syrian regime to just sort of drag their heels on this. But it keeps that diplomatic option on the table as a way for us to maybe ultimately get what we want in a way that could even be safer than military strikes in terms of the removal and destruction of Syrian chemical weapons, and to have done it without that actual military, the rush to the military strike first, and then trying to follow that up with diplomacy.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are UW-La Crosse Political Science Department Assistant Professor Adam Van Leer and Viterbo University History Professor Keith Knudsen. We're talking about the situation in Syria. I want to talk about the United States because we don't have a perfect history when it comes to chemical weapons. The use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, reports, you know, in the last decade or so have talked about chemical experiments that the Army performed even within people on U.S. soil during the Cold War era. Has our history been forgotten, or have we learned from past mistakes?
Well, I think too often history can be overlooked, and it's not always useful to analyze ourselves and our own contributions to certain problems that we're trying to solve at a particular moment. But I think we as Americans have some right for pride in that we have been prime instigators in a lot of these international institutional arrangements that are trying to reel in particular uses. Now, of course, we are a society that has developed all of these weapons that we want to prohibit around the world. We have also engaged in the reduction of nuclear forces. We have attempted to reduce our stockpiles in these weapons. I think for a government, any government, it gets into a situation where if another side might possibly use these kinds of weapons, then, and this is what the military strike in Syria at the current moment is all about, how do we deter the use of these? Well, we have them, so you, if you have them, and then we have them, okay, don't use them because we'll retaliate with them. And of course, now we're in a circumstance where we're trying to make an international principle that any use of these weapons will cross, in the president's term, a red line. That is, use of these weapons is now going to be considered unacceptable if the principle gets to play out through the process that we're talking about.
No, the United States should not necessarily forget its own history with the development of such weapons. But at the same time, when we look at the world today, when we look at a regime that has apparently actually engaged in or used chemical warfare against its own citizens, the concern is if the United States, if the international community does not respond in some sort of strong manner to these actions, will we start to see other regimes around the world who might have these stockpiles, who might have access to these types of chemical and biological weapons, use them whenever they're faced with the types of challenges that the Assad regime has faced as part of the Syrian civil war? And so I think that's part of what's going on here is not necessarily forgetting about or ignoring our own history with these, but also thinking about how has the international system changed, and if we look at where we're headed in the future.
It's important for us as Americans to remember that after World War II and our experience in World War II, when we did use nuclear weapons twice against a nation that attacked us, but using those weapons against civilians, afterwards we purposefully and determinedly began a process of building very more effective international institutions. I think sometimes we want to overlook our involvement in that construction, especially when we want to do something that we would prefer to do in our own national self-interest. And of course, constructing these international regimes is one of the basic principles of it all, is that we are, I'm a student of the European Union, and so they talk about pooling sovereignty, engaging in a collective powerful sovereignty, meaning ultimate authority, integrating that authority of the most powerful society on the planet, the United States of America, with others with whom we can find common ground, common principles. And of course, in our own minds, we're always trying to construct a better planet, I suppose, in the big picture sense, we might say.
So let's talk about a couple of the scenarios that could play out. You've both talked about the most recent development where Russia's implying that, you know, Syria could hand over its chemical weapons either to the UN or some other body. But that doesn't completely eliminate the fact that the U.S. could strike Syria. You know, if that were to happen, how are we not at war?
I have asked my classes on several occasions, how do we use military weaponry and tell ourselves and the world that we are not engaged in war? Since World War II, we've come up with this term, policing action.
Because is it since World War II, we have, Congress has not declared official war? Am I correct on that?
You are correct on that.
Oh, okay.
We have not declared war.
We have had congressional resolutions that give the president the authority to use the United States military, but no declaration of war. As a matter of fact, the first war after World War II, Korea, there was not even a congressional resolution. President Truman got a UN resolution that, in his estimation, was good enough so that he didn't even ask the Congress for its support in our war activity, which I think created some problems for Harry Truman as the war dragged on. That's why presidents go to the Congress to get these resolutions. My understanding is these declarations of war are rather historically passé now, that societies may not want to make a declaration of war for all of the legal ramifications and then the necessity of mobilizing the population in the effort.
The United States has only declared war five times in its history, with World War II being the last time. And part of it is the sort of the legal ramifications, what it takes to actually mobilize a country if you're going to have Congress declare war. And so what you've seen is, particularly in the post-World War II era, this greater reliance on these sort of policing actions, these types of the use of the U.S. military towards some purpose. And you do get things like the War Powers Act from the 70s that limits how long the president is able to actually use military force before seeking congressional approval, before getting Congress to sign off on this. And so it's part of this is the kind of fluid nature between the executive and the legislative branch on, all right, when the United States' national security or national interest is somehow threatened, are we able to respond effectively and timely? There is a lot that goes into it, and that's part of what's made this the debate about what to do about Syria interesting is that I know up until the Russians had proposed, can we have Syria give their chemical weapons to international monitors? I mean, a lot of the debate was, well, why did President Obama in this case decide he was going to seek congressional approval for an action, whereas in other cases maybe he would have engaged in the military strikes first and then gone to Congress.
Does it come down to, Keith, you talked before about this congressional hesitation on these actions. Does it come down to that?
Well, I think in this case, to show us how integrated our world has become, the president decided to go to Congress only after the British Parliament said no to its prime minister's request for a resolution supporting the use of the British military. I think this is a positive development. I think that if any president is going to use our awesome military power, then the president should be getting the consent of the people, the people's representatives. Now, Adam referred to moments of national emergency, and I think as the commander-in-chief, any president has the clear authority constitutionally to respond to an emergency. This situation in Syria is not a direct threat to us. The president has made the case, at least tried to make the case, if we let this pass in Syria now, perhaps then someday these weapons will somehow, some way affect we Americans. The same argument that was basically made for justifying the invasion of Iraq. Although the Middle East is an intricate element of the world economic system, especially with oil, which Syria doesn't have much of, I understand.
Only 0.1% of the world's source.
If we were to go into Syria, we wouldn't do it for the oil. But we would do it for the principle, also the location. Syria has a long history of being a very influential society in the Middle East. the Arabian Nights come, well, from Baghdad, but the first capital of the Islamic Empire was Damascus. And so it's a centerpiece of the Middle East. And as much as this president has tried to maybe move us out of our consumption with the Middle East, it's hard for us to get away from that because it is a volatile, intricate area of the world that has been unstable for a variety of reasons. We may not get into that today, but the instability of the Middle East can have an impact on us.
And I want to pick up what Keith said about when we think of the British Parliament and their sort of recent vote against the United Kingdom, and part of it is when the United States, when we look at the United Kingdom, they have been a strong ally of ours in the past. And so here we would already know we're going into some kind of a military engagement without a partner who supported us on the invasion of Iraq. And so that does probably give the president, the administration, some pause. I do sometimes wonder from my perspective as sort of an international relations, looking at American foreign policy, was the decision by the president to go to Congress partly based on other political calculations, given opposition in Congress, given some of the reaction to U.S. involvement in Libya? Does this provide the president with, in some ways, a way to either get Congress on board with the action ahead of time, and so they can't come back and yell at him later? If Congress says no, it's not necessarily going to rule out the president's ability to, down the road, use military force if he thinks it's needed. But in this situation, it might provide a chance to step back.
The lesson from Vietnam is quite germane. That is, two successive American presidents, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, both got themselves into some very deep trouble politically here at home. And of course, even legally, because they exercised American military power, if I may say, under their own authority without really consulting with the American public. I mean, I think both those presidents were quite secretive about their decision-making in the Vietnam War process. Our presidential leaders have taken that lesson and have consulted with the American public. And of course, our public may not be necessarily following the civil war in Syria on a very regular basis, and so not paying such close attention and not fully prepared to make a decision right away.
The AP released a poll this week that showed that only one in five Americans supported the U.S. getting involved with Syria. So it shows, that's one poll, but shows that it's not popular amongst the public.
I think last week the opposition has actually grown as Americans have learned more about the situation. We may all not be well-trained to deal with foreign policy, but in a consent-based republic, well, then that consent to engage in the use of our military might is an essential principle that however a president gets to that point of seeking that consent, that's a positive development for us.
Do you think it's because the American public is becoming more informed, or are they just becoming fatigued by all these conflicts in the Middle East?
Talking to my students about American foreign policy, teaching classes on American foreign policy, I think a lot of it has to do with the fatigue. I think there is a greater awareness now, if we think about today and as people are trying to make decisions. But even there, you find foreign policy is one of those areas that the American public is generally the least knowledgeable about. And in some cases, public opinion can be the most easily swayed by presenting new information or more information about the topic. I think some of the initial hesitation among the American public is more it's this fatigue that's just set in over a decade or so of wars in the Middle East. Part of it then as more information about, well, the uncertainties of what this strike would look like, as information about Russia providing this alternative sort of plan comes out, does it just give people more reason to say, maybe now's not the time for a military strike?
Keith?
And I think one might also hope that then the public is beginning to come to terms with, although deterrence is a pretty important principle in the study of international relations and one way we might prevent war, deterrence might not be the preferred option for a growing segment of our public. And then that might also imply that perhaps we could begin a process of investing less of our wealth into this military-industrial complex that is so influential in our society and in our governing apparatus that perhaps we as a public are beginning to realize that we don't want to be the world's policeman, we don't want to make these investments, and of course the world is still a fairly volatile and even dangerous place. Somehow there might be new means by which we can regulate human conflict and the construction of an international legal regime, as problematic as that can be and as painstakingly difficult it is to build and as slow as the results will be, perhaps we're in a transition to a new paradigm. That's pretty fancy talk, I know, and maybe quite idealistic. But from speaking with students in this millennial generation, I think there is some aspiration of moving in that direction.
Do you two want to make any predictions as to how you think events will unfold over the next weeks, months?
I think that the Russian proposal holds some hope that if the president even himself is thinking that he's going to get off the hook from engaging in a military action that would be unpopular here, Secretary of State Kerry, kind of an offhand comment, instigated the Russians apparently to engage in this. I guess I've kind of given myself away. I would prefer to see a diplomatic solution to this. And so I think that there is some possibility because now the Russians have a stake in implementing that. Of course, we want to insist that they're going to and ensure that they're going to be honest brokers and that the Syrians will actually engage in the activity and they're not just stalling. But I think there's some chance that developments through the Russian proposal at the UN could bring about some positive results and avoid the military conflict.
Adam?
Particularly if you can get the United Nations to agree to and the Russians to not block some kind of resolution that will sort of help solidify a time frame for this type of action of handing over chemical weapons to the international community for destruction, you name it. I think we might actually see this system play out, so sort of a diplomatic solution to the particular crisis that we're facing in a manner that does not necessarily constrain the United States or the United Kingdom or France from in the future if there's additional atrocities that are committed. It's not taking the military option completely off the table should it be warranted down the road. But a lot of it does come back to this whole, you know, is this Russian proposal, are the Syrians going to be serious in committing to it, or is this going to be a stalling tactic? But again, you know, it's not that if the United States pursues this sort of diplomatic option, it's not that it means President Obama can't decide to use the military option down the road if it seems like this is, if there's more reports of chemical weapons attacks on people in Syria.
Adam Van Leer is an assistant professor in the political science department at UW-La Crosse, and Keith Knutson is a professor in the history department at Viterbo University. We've been talking about issues related to the use of chemical weapons in Syria and the response of other countries to the situation. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. You'll also find extended interviews, photos, and web links. And if you'd like to comment on our program, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.